This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with another attorney from the People's Law Office, Flint Taylor. He uncovered in his prosecuting the torture in Chicago of 101 black men whose confessions were extorted and who are serving prison sentences.
Even on death row, Chicago, torture, homegrown.
Playwright Zaid Dorn will be joining us to discuss his latest in New York City, the Haymarket play.
The play starts December 8th. In the 1880s, they were called anarchists. Today, they're called terrorists.
All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, ACLU's Arab Muslim South Asian advocate.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Couple weeks ago on a little-known story, Capitol Hill Blue reported that the White House keeps dossiers on more than 10,000 political enemies. Now, the Bush administration, when you're talking about political enemies, they define them pretty widely. And we're talking about people who are either high-ranking local, state, or federal officials that are prominent in the media and ordinary citizens who may have at one time or another disagreed with the Bush administration. So they've got this enemies list that dates back to the time when Bush was confined to Texas in his rule. And it continues to today, and it was just exposed. What do you guys think of this? Who's on it?
I thought the LA stopped updating this list a year ago and that they'd given it to many companies and businesses, and they're still using outdated lists.
Oh, is that right?
That's what I read.
Guy, is this about national security or is it just about people who oppose Bush and his policies and therefore they want to make sure the business goes to his friends?
I don't think they know the difference between national security and opposing policy. I think they conflate the two.
Yeah, well, I think the reason that Michael brought the question up was that in the 60s there was a national security list, which I was on. Right. Were you on that list,
yes,
Michael?
Yes, the National Security Index.
The index. And if you were on the index, in case of what they called, quote, a national emergency, they'd pick you up and put you in a concentration camp.
Right. There was a special legislation in Congress that allowed them to do that.
They had four concentration camps set up. And
which
there was
one
a list.
Did you go to?
Well, you know, we stopped the war in Vietnam without getting busted.
Mine was
busted.
Called the Golden Door or something?
Yeah. But there was a list of people to be picked up, and there's no indication that list was ever destroyed. It's still operative. But now I think what you're talking about, Dahlia, is an additional list of enemies of the Bush administration.
And they've been giving it to banks, casinos even. One man was stopped at a casino because his name came up.
So it's not just about people they want to oppose. It's people who they also think might be hurt their security
at who compiled the list. Carl Rove.
Oh, so it's
it's
everything.
So it is.
Do you think any of us are on that list?
Well, you for sure.
No,
You know what I'm worried about with their use of these so-called national security letters, where on their own, without having to go to a judge, they can go get your medical records, your financial records, your
now that's a different issue than this list.
Yeah, but they can
explain what that is.
But they can combine the two.
Well, wait, we want to explain what that is.
Michael,
first.
What is it?
They have the power of the state. So not only do they have a private list of their enemies, but they can use the police force, in this case the FBI, which is the secret political police force, to gather information on their own without having to go to a judge. In complete violation of the Fourth Amendment privacy, they can just issue a letter, say, to a library or a bookstore or to a hospital or to a shrink.
Now, Dahlia, I don't remember national security letters. The real nasty thing about them is if they're investigating, let's say, Michael Smith, they can go on a national security letter and simply go to almost anybody and say, this is pertinent to a terrorism investigation. It doesn't have to have anything to do with Michael Smith. They can say, we need this information for a terrorism investigation that they could go check out, see what books I took out, or go to my records, or go
private
to my
information.
Bank. Now, what I don't recall, Dahlia, is there's a national security letter, and then there's another kind of thing. They have to go to a judge, but the judge has to sign it. That's different than a national
I think that's different.
A national security letter is just a straight, Michael is saying, that you can just get a letter from the FBI that says, give us all the records on Dahlia Hashad from this bank or her garage or whatever else, or her video store, et cetera.
They have to comply, and you can't ever reveal that this has been asked of you and that you've received this, and 30,000.
Or you go to prison if you reveal that the FBI came and asked you.
And let's hear that number, because this is where Ashcroft really said, we hardly ever do this, and recently we've had a number. What is it, Dahlia?
30,000.
Right. And ACLU has a lawsuit in Connecticut about this, where the actual party whose records are sought cannot be disclosed, couldn't be, was said, it's the same kind of rule. You can't tell you've been asked for these records. But they, unfortunately for the FBI, they left the name in a lot of the records that they were supposed to white or black out. And so now we know the name of the group, and it was published in the New York Times today.
Yeah.
Library Connection, for all of you who don't know.
Right. And you can go to ACLU.tv and look at the first Freedom Files episode, and you can see a little bit about the national security letters. You can also go to the website, ACLU.org, and you can get general information about the national security letters, what they are, and what's happened in the lawsuit.
And what's wrong with the secret police knowing everything about you? What's wrong with it is that it's totally contrary to democracy in this sense. If you have a democracy, you have to have anonymity. You have to be able to have some security in your thoughts, in your conversations, in your writings. And if the government can know what you're thinking and what you're writing and who you're visiting and what you're seeing and what you're reading, you have no ability to join with others to change the government, which should be your government. So it stands the whole thing on its head, yeah. And that's what we call a police state.
I just watched our latest in the series of Freedom Files TV shows on ACLU.tv, the one on dissent. I have a client in there, Amir Suleiman. But it was all about the dissent and what happens when the government starts clamping down. And there's one man who was shot at a peaceful protest with wooden bullets. And he talks about very compellingly about the impact that has on him and his feeling of being able to come out publicly and say, I don't agree with this government, in a very peaceful way.
I remember when my friend Jim Lafferty was shot at with a rubber bullet in Los Angeles during the demonstrations against
Democratic National Convention.
Yeah. And you know what saved him? The bullet was deflected by a yellow legal pad.
Now, Dahlia, I know that you guys have been working on this at the ACLU, but this is all we have. So far, we have the 30,000 names that the White House has of special people. We have 30,000 national security letters. And then we have recent activities in the Patriot Act in the Senate. Can you give us a sense of what just happened in the last few days over the efforts to shorten the Patriot Act?
Well, it's a disaster. I mean, do we?
Yeah, because instead of extending it for 10 years, they agreed to only extend the worst provisions for 7 years.
Well, the funny thing was, in the House bill, they'd agreed to 4, and in the Senate bill, they agreed to 4, and then they go to conference, and suddenly you find these provisions.
That.
Yes. When you go to conferences, you've got a bill in the House, and you've got a bill in the Senate, and you have to bridge the distance between the two. 4 years and 4 years, they go into conference and they come out extending some of the worst provisions to 7 years.
But let's back up a second and talk about when this Patriot Act was first put in. It was right after 9/11, 3 weeks after 9/11, 342-page act. They scared the pants off the Congress. They got the thing passed without anybody ever having read it.
And they pressured people.
And they certainly did. And remember, and people were calling up the ACLU the day after it passed, asking what they voted for.
Right.
So they got the thing in place. It was all these awful laws that they had tried to get passed before that they never could. They collected them all. And then when 9/11 happened, it was a silver platter. They put this bill on the silver platter. They got it through Congress. But they said, we promise you we're going to reconsider. And the bad
stuff
we're
going to
take out.
Yep. Right.
It's going to be the Sunset Act. The sun's going to set on the worst provisions.
And those are surveillance provisions. One of the scariest things to me, and I think the scariest things to a lot of people, were things like the sneak and peek allowed by the Patriot Act, which basically, I mean, it's always been a longstanding legal tradition in the United States that if the government has a warrant and they have good cause to search your home,
probable cause
to search your home or your business or your personal effects, that they have to come to your door and they knock on it when you are home, and you have the right to look at the warrant and recognize whether it's valid or not, and then watch them to make sure that they're limited to searching only to the on the places that they're allowed to on the warrant and seizing only the things that they're permitted to. And now what the government has the ability to do is to go to your home and wait until you leave. You go shopping. You go on vacation. You go to work for 8 hours. And they enter your home. And they can search wherever they want, take whatever they want, and you will never know where they've been.
And they don't need probable cause.
And that the sneak and peek searches, there's a broad standard that they said that there was going to be 30 and 90 day time limits on how long they can refrain from telling you that you've been searched. However, under what's happened recently, the new Patriot reauthorization, the searches can be secret for, under special circumstances, for weeks, for months, or maybe years. With us, Amir Suleiman. He's a Black American Muslim, born in America, raised in America. He's 26 years old. He's a poet, writer, teacher, husband, and father. What happened to him, I think you'll find truly amazing. He was teaching in Atlanta, and he taught creative writing and English and social studies, and he's also a poet kind of on the side. And he decided to submit a videotape of him reading his various poems to HBO's Deaf Poetry Jam. That's Russell Simmons' show, where for a half hour they feature poets reading all kinds of different original pieces. He gets selected to be flown up to New York. In New York, the deal is everybody reads two poems, and they film them in front of a live audience. And you may or may not get picked to be on the air, depending on how it goes. So the producer says to him, "We really love the one poem. I think it's called Eve Among Beasts. And it's a love poem." And she says, "That's just a great poem. I hope you read it." And he's sitting backstage while everyone's reading, and he's thinking to himself, "Well, you know, I could read that love poem, and I'm sure to get on the air, but I really want to be saying something on TV. I want to be saying something political." So he decided eventually to read two poems that were very political, one called Dead Man Walking and another called Danger. He goes on stage and he reads Danger. It goes very well. The audience goes wild. And he goes backstage. It's a poem about political oppression and social oppression of all different kinds around the world and throughout history. So he goes backstage, and Russell Simmons comes back and congratulates him and says, "I love that poem. That poem is going to be on the show. That poem's amazing." The poem goes on the air in August, and he goes from Atlanta with his wife and his kids to Northern California, where his mother-in-law lives. They're going to a family wedding. And he's recording an album, so he happens to be in the studio with Guapale, a local artist, recording a song about political prisoners when he gets a phone call saying the FBI is here. Four FBI agents showed up at his mother-in-law's house and questioned for several hours his brother-in-law while they waited for Amir to come home. And they asked questions about who he was, where he worked, mainly about his anti-American poetry. Amir came home and refused to speak with them. And when he got back to Atlanta, he found out that the FBI had gone to his place of employment, to the principal of the school where he taught. And they presented a subpoena. They wanted, among other things, I guess they wanted his employee records. And they wanted the name, address, and phone number of every student that had ever been under the instruction of Amir Suleiman. We have with us Amir Suleiman. He's currently on tour, on the Most Deaf tour. He has an album coming out in February.
Amir, welcome to Law and Disorder. You're here with Heidi Bogosian from the National Lawyers Guild, Dalia Hashad from the ACLU, Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I'm Michael Smith. And we're very happy to have you on the phone. We've got news from Dalia about what's been happening to you. Sure. Give us an update since the FBI came out to your mother-in-law's home.
After they came out to my home, it's been basically them not dealing directly with me, but the people around me. So, like, originally, like, when they came to my mother-in-law's and they go to the place where I worked, the school at which I worked, and got a grand jury subpoena and called some people that I visited and visited some people that I visited. So that has been a type of environment that they've created around this issue. The thing that has been successful, though, my best defense is exactly what I'm doing now, and it's me speaking out about it and keeping the pressure on them and not taking a defensive posture. And that has been the thing that has given me the most breathing room in this situation.
And this is all because you wrote and spoke a poem, is that right?
Right. Well, when they came to see me, it's very ambiguous because when they come to see me, we didn't talk because I told them I didn't want to talk to them without representation. And by the time I got representation, they really didn't want to talk anymore. So,
everybody contacted by the FBI should do the same.
Yes.
So have you written another poem about what they're doing to you now?
Actually, all of my poems were kind of about that anyway. So myself, as a black man in America, as a Muslim in America, a lot of my work has been around not this particular issue, but the system of tyranny and the system of fascism in this country and worldwide.
But a lot of people talk about these types of things, Amir. What is it? What's special about you that makes you interesting to the FBI, do you think?
You know, that's something I'm curious about myself, even. I think it is because what I say is very emotional, it's very heartfelt, but it's not irrational. And, you know, I'm young and I'm black and I'm big and I'm Muslim and I have a little beard and a kufi, and I think for some people that makes them a
You're their worst nightmare.
Right.
Let me ask you something. When the FBI asks questions to your friends, what kind of questions do they ask? What are they interested in?
They ask, like, is Amir trying to spread Islam through hip-hop? And...
Really?
No.
Come on. Are you serious?
I'm serious. And I'm thinking to myself, what is the right answer? So if I say... Okay, if I say, no, that's a lie. Or what if I say, yeah? Like, okay, so what? I mean, you caught me away to prison? I mean, what does that mean? Well, I mean, what information, either way, is that going to provide for you? And I think to myself, these are my hard-earned tax dollars at work here.
Amir, were you nervous before you got on stage and read your poem? Did you have any idea this kind of thing might happen?
Not like this. The poem that I had written, Danger, was a very, it felt like a very personal poem. And the way that I wrote it and the way that I speak it, that I present it, is in a very it's a very intense poem. And as a matter of fact, when I was writing it, I thought it was so intense that, like, they weren't going to let me read it in the poetry arena even.
Because it might not have broad appeal.
Right.
And in fact, it was the opposite.
It was exactly opposite. So it got me, it propelled me to, you know, HBO Deaf Poetry and, you know, more and more people. Like, I still get emails about it now from the performance on HBO, and Russell Simmons came backstage and shook my hand and said, "You're so blessed for me to be there." And, you know, and I'm surprised all the time. Like, I didn't know you felt this way. So what I found is that there are a few groups of people. There's a group of people, they don't know what's going on, and this is a reminder for them. Then there's a group of people that know what's going on, but they need a reminder because it's easy to forget. And those people appreciate the work. And then there's some people that know what's going on, but they don't like to be reminded, and I remind them anyway. A lot of people, what I find, feel the way that I felt. They just didn't either have the platform, the language, or the courage to say what I've said, but they feel the same way, which was a surprise to me.
Or they don't have the ability, as in my case, they don't have the ability to say it in a beautiful art. Here, let's play that poem.
I am not angry. I am anger. I am not dangerous. I am danger. I am abominable, stress, ciliatic, relentless. I'm a breath of vengeance. I'm a death sentence. I'm forsaken repentance to the beast and its henchmen, armed forces and policemen that survive off of oil and prisons until their cup runneth over with lost souls that wear oversized caps like blindfolds, shiny necklaces like lassos, dragging them into black holes. I may have to holler at Fidel Castro to get my other brothers out of Guantanamo. and the innocents on death row is probably in the same proportions of criminals in black robes that smack gavels, that smash homes, that smack gavels, that crack domes. Justice is somewhere between reading sad poems and 40 ounces of gasoline crash at the windows. Justice is between plans and action, between writing letters to congressmen and clapping a captain, between raising legal defense funds and putting a gun on a bailiff and taking a judge captive. It is between prayer and fasting, between burning and blasting. Freedom is between the mind and the soul. It is between the lock and the load, between the zeal of the young and the patience of the old. Freedom is between the finger and the trigger. It's between the page and the pen, between the grenade and the pen, between righteous anger and keeping one in the chamber. So what are they going to do with a man with a heart like Turner, a mind like Douglas, a mouth like Malcolm, and a voice like Chris? That's why I am not dangerous. I am danger. I am not angry. I am anger. I am abominable stress, idiotic, relentless. I'm a breath of vengeance. I'm a death sentence. I'm forsaken repentance of the beast and his henchmen, armed forces and policemen. I will slice his belly open and free the souls of the Navajo, the souls of the Iroquois, the souls of the Igbo, the souls of the Scottsboro boys, the souls of great black leaders, the souls of Kandahar and Baghdad. I burn my white and raise my black flag to free the souls of great black leaders and the souls of nameless niggas, the souls of self-wholesome, the souls of Attica, the pieces of Asada still left on the prison floor, the souls of the crownless queens and self-proclaimed whores, and the cell of Imam Jamil Al-Amin must be filled with sweet scent of his absence. But until then, I am not dangerous. I am danger. I am not angry. I am anger. I am abominable stress, ciliatic, relentless. I'm a breath of vengeance. I'm a death sentence. I'm forsaken repentance to the beast and his henchmen, politicians and big businessmen. I'm a teenage Palestinian opening fire at an Israeli checkpoint, point blank, checkmate. Now what? I'm a rape victim with her gun cocked to his cock, cock, bang, bang, cock, now what? I'm an inmate, short shank to the CO, earlobe to earlobe, cut short, case closed, now what? I am Sitting Bull with Colonel Custer's scalp in his hands. I am Sin K with a slave trader's blood on my hands. I am Jonathan Jackson handing a gun to my man. I am David with a slingshot and a rock. And if David lived today, he'd have a Molotov cocktail and a Glock. So I say down with Goliath, I say down with Goliath, but we must learn, know, write, read, we must kick, bite, yell, scream, we must pray, fast, live, dream, fight, kill, and die free.
Amir Suleiman is joining us from Oakland, California on the phone.
If our listeners want to hear you, do you have a website or a CD out or something? Can you tell us how we can hear more of you?
Yes, both, actually.
Tell.
The website is AmirSuleiman.com, which is AmirSuleiman.com. And you might need that twice, so I'm going to give it to him again. It's AmirSuleiman. And I have an album out right now called Dead Man Walking. And another album coming out in 2006 called Like a Thief in the Night.
Great. Let me ask you one
question. Real quick, though, if you have trouble remembering that, you can go to ACLU.tv and Amir is in. You can actually watch Amir and some other stories in the Dissent episode of the Freedom Files online.
Great.
Right.
One question. You mentioned when you were talking about the FBI that there was a grand jury subpoena. Is that true? I don't understand. Not was it true, but they really tried or they just threatened people?
No, the school at which I taught, I was teaching school at the time, and so they went to the school at which I taught and got a grand jury subpoena for my personal file and for the names and phone numbers of my students, anyone that I've taught in my tenure there at the school.
And the school cooperated with them, right?
Well, they had to, but actually at the last moment, the FBI revoked it or they got around it. I'm not even sure exactly how it ended up happening, but the part that was most troubling for me was that the school had to send out letters to the parents of the students, you know, because they were about to release this information.
With your name in it?
Yeah, they were saying, well...
explaining what happened?
Right. Unfortunately, the school is very supportive of me, very, very supportive. I can't be thankful enough. And so even in the language of the letter, they basically talk like, you know, the FBI is up to their old, you know, their old tricks or whatever. So
Great.
And they said, and the principal said that if he could hire me again tomorrow, he would.
Great.
So, that's great.
So it was very, very supportive. But, yeah, they put out a grand jury subpoena for that information.
Amir, what's been the impact of this? I mean, you've been incredibly courageous, and more courageous, I think, than anyone I know who's been questioned by the FBI and attacked in this way or, you know, really up there. But what has been the impact of being questioned by the FBI and hounded by them?
It is a feeling of presence, you know? It is a feeling of being watched, it's kind of like, you know, in a very vague or abstract way, anyone that is speaking, you know, in a manner of, the people that I would like to emulate, like the footsteps that I would like to walk in are people like, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. or people like Malcolm X or, you know, these types of people. And these people in the FBI are like arch enemies. I mean, in their documents and stuff, they talk during these people's lifetimes. Even people like Rosa Parks and things like this, they talk about these people with a feeling of adversity. That is kind of present in my consciousness as a black man and as a Muslim, as a person that speaks on these issues. But then, in addition to that, it is a feeling of more precise and focused attention on me and watching me as an individual. But in many ways, it inspires me. I almost feel like they picked the wrong person to come and see. So it inspires me to speak with more urgency about our condition, not just in this country but around the world, to speak more urgently for justice, to speak more urgently for freedom and for the rights that human beings should enjoy. So they served as a very clear reminder of why I do what I do and the need for it.
We've played that poem that started this all here on the air, but you can listen to it again at AmirSuleiman.com. Amir, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Amir, you've got
Thank
our
you.
Respect
Thank
and our
you.
Solidarity.
It was an honor.
Keep it up.
Thank you.
All from the Indians, welcome to pilgrims. And to the buffaloes who once ruled the plain, like the vultures circling beneath the dark clouds, looking for the rain, looking for the rain, just like the cities that stagger on the coastline. In a nation that just can't stand much more, like the forest buried beneath the highway, never had a chance to grow, never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter. Winter in America. Yes, and all of the hills have been killed. Sent away. Yeah, but the people know it's winter. Winter in America.
I'd like to welcome Attorney Flint Taylor from the People's Law Office in Chicago onto Law and Disorder. Flint, I'm here with Dalia Hashad, who's the head of Arab, Muslim, Southeast Asian Outreach for the ACLU, and we've Heidi Boghossian, who's the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, as well as Michael Ratner. Our show is Law and Disorder. It's the first time we've had you on, although we all, of course, know about you and admire you. And welcome to Law and Disorder, Flint Taylor.
Thank you very much.
Flint, I've been following the case that you've been working on for quite some time. The issue of torture has become kind of synonymous with the Bush administration, but in Chicago it goes all the way back. And I wanted to ask you what you've been able to uncover there about the conduct of the Chicago Police Department in the torture and frame-up and sentencing of well over 100 black men. Flint, when did you start working on this, and what have you found out?
Well, we started working on this almost 20 years ago in 1987. and that we started working on it in relationship to a black man who had been charged and convicted of two murders of two Chicago police officers, white officers, and he had been tortured at the Area 2 police headquarters. And he couldn't get a lawyer to represent him in a civil rights case that he had brought pro se. And he was alleging, when I use the term torture, I mean electric shock, I mean having a plastic bag put over his head, being beaten, and being burned across a hot radiator. These were the allegations he was making. They were being ignored, and he brought his own lawsuit. And that's how we got first involved. He called us out of desperation, and we decided to represent him pro bono, and we've been litigating police torture cases ever since.
And about how many incidences of torture, how many people have you found out have had this done to them in Chicago?
Well, we started out with him. And during the middle of we had a trial, a civil rights trial in 1989, and in the middle of it, I started to get letters from an anonymous police source who worked with Burge. And he tipped us off, Burge being the head of the torture ring at Area 2. And he tipped us off that the Andrew Wilson case was not a single lone case, but that there were other victims. He gave us the name of other victims, and he gave us the name of other people who he referred to as Burge's ass kickers, which was, in fact, Burge's torture crew. So we went out and we started to talk to these other victims that he tipped us off to, and also what we started to do is to unpeel this onion of cases of police torture. It became 15, and then it became 25, and then a few years later we were up to 60, and what we were finding was that there were all these different cases over the years of 1972 to 1991 that were arising in this one station house under this one commander with this same set of detectives being the ones named. And what we were also finding out was that in these individual cases, many of these men had documented it by testifying in their own cases, and in each case it was rejected by the courts, and the police came in each time and lied about the fact that they had committed these torturous acts.
How many cases did you eventually uncover?
Well, it keeps going up. We now have 101 documented cases. There's been a special prosecutor that many years after the fact has finally been appointed, and he says he has 135 cases. So,
are they all black men?
They're all black. They're not all men. There was a couple of women involved. But, yes, they're all African-American, all the ones we know about, and I assume all of the 135.
When these confessions were extorted by these people, wasn't current Mayor Richard Daley a state's prosecutor for six of those years?
Daley has his fingerprints all over this. And this is one.
In what ways?
It started out in that Wilson case. He was the prosecutor at that time, and the police superintendent at that time was specifically called, made aware of the torture of Andrew Wilson in 1982 by the director of the hospital at the jail, who wrote him a letter and said, "I demand an investigation. This man has serious injuries, and he alleges he was tortured." The police superintendent, in a classic cover-your-ass memorandum, wrote a letter to the state's attorney of Cook County, Richard Daley, Richard the Younger, and said, "Look, normally I would investigate serious allegations like this, but since you've got a very serious death penalty case against the victim, I won't do anything unless you tell me to." And, of course, Daley did nothing except prosecute Andrew Wilson based on the tortured confession and got the death penalty against him. Then Daley continued to be the state's attorney for six or seven more years. And during that time, we now know that there were 55 different cases of police torture that arose out of Area 2. And in each and every one of those cases, you have to understand, these confessions were taken by state's attorneys who worked under Daley. And state's attorneys not only took the confessions, they were often told by the victims that they were being tortured. On a few occasions, the state's attorneys allegedly participated in the torture. And in each case, the state's attorney's office defended against motions to suppress the tortured confessions in court. So the state's attorney's office and Daley specifically had his fingerprints all over these cases in terms of knowing about them, doing nothing about prosecuting the torturers, and in fact defending against allegations of torture, which sent many men to the penitentiary, including 11 men to death row.
We're talking to those who've just tuned into Law and Disorder with Attorney Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office in Chicago, who's undercovered a huge, huge scandal of domestic torture in Chicago. He's been working on these cases for many years. Flint, where do these cases stand now, and what do you hope to accomplish?
Well, there's been a tremendous amount of struggle around these cases ever since the mid-'80s when, as I said, that we started to uncover the fact that it was not only one instance of torture, but it was a pattern in practice, a systemic nature of torture. And at one point, there were demonstrations. They took over a city council meeting. There were hearings. There were marches in front of the mayor's house. And finally, in 1991, the police department moved to fire John Burge, but only for one case, that being the Andrew Wilson case. And this was almost entirely the result of the uproar that came from the uncovering of all of this evidence of torture. So he was ultimately fired. But all of the men working under him, they never laid a glove on. And even though there were investigations into many of these cases, and some investigators recommended that others be fired, this was all covered up by the police superintendent and the head of the disciplinary agency.
So this domestic torture scandal is happening in Chicago. What's your sense that this is being duplicated in cities all across the nation?
Well, you know, I did do a fairly detailed study about torture in the United States, and it's clear that there is torture of various kinds in the prisons and in the police stations around the country. I don't think that you're going to find such a sustained torture scandal as you have here in Chicago in terms of the number of people that were being tortured, the kinds of torture that was being used, the fact that successive police superintendents were involved, the fact that the state's attorney of Cook County, one of the largest Cook counties in the country, was on notice and involved. And he then, of course, became our mayor. And while he was mayor, He, along with the police superintendent, suppressed a police study which said that there was systematic torture at this area police station.
Why do you think it's so bad in Chicago?
Well, Chicago has a rich history of the third degree of torture or abuse of citizens. I don't think it's unlike some of the other areas around the country. Certainly New Orleans is an extremely brutal place. New York City has had its scandals around torture. I think that it's interesting, though, in the cases I've seen that came out of New York, they actually did prosecute some officers for torturing suspects out there. Here, the mayor and the state's attorney, very powerful man by the name of Richard Devine, is the state's attorney now. He was the lawyer for John Burge in the cases that Andrew Wilson brought against him. So he went from being Burge's lawyer to being the prosecutor in charge of the Cook County prosecutions. So, of course, he had a tremendous conflict of interest. He wouldn't recognize that conflict of interest, but instead moved to protect his former client and never investigated all these allegations of torture. Subsequently, the judge in charge of the criminal courts division reluctantly appointed a special prosecutor. So that's where we are. 35 years after this torture started, we now have a special prosecutor, a former judge, who's looking into all of these allegations of torture. But it's 35 years later, and so a lot of people are claiming that the statute of limitations has run out on a lot of these allegations.
Calls to mind Lenny Bruce's observation about Chicago. He said, Chicago is so corrupt, it's thrilling.
Well, you know, thrilling might not be the best word, but it certainly is mind-boggling. The fact that it's now being investigated, the fact that four men were taken off of death row by Governor Ryan and pardoned on the basis of innocence, based on the evidence that all four of them were tortured at Area 2, those four men now have cases in court. We are litigating those cases, the civil rights cases, on behalf of those pardoned men, and we're uncovering additional evidence. And what's interesting in terms of the continuing cover-up is that all of these lawyers that are representing all of the torturers and all of the superintendents are paid for by the city of Chicago. We now have a bill of $6 million that's been paid by the city of Chicago to finance lawyers who are defending all of these police officers. And the other interesting thing is that before they just lied and followed the code of silence and said they didn't torture anybody. Now we've had over 35 detectives, supervisors, and others who are implicated in this pattern and practice of torture in to take sworn depositions. All 35 of them have taken the Fifth Amendment as to each and every question they've been asked about police torture and their involvement in it. So now the new methodology of covering up is to take the Fifth Amendment. Yeah. And so the city is now paying lawyers handsome amounts of money to defend these guys and to advise them to take the Fifth Amendment.
Flint Taylor, racial profiling typically tends to bleed absent a race-specific policy. So I'm a little bit curious. You have 101 cases, and they all are African-American. Chicago has a huge Latino population. Are there any Latino cases of abuse and torture, or are you just not seeing?
Well, you know, when we use the word torture, we're talking about a very specific definition, as you all know, that arises from the UN and other places. We're talking about the kind of tactics of electric shock, dry submarino, mock executions, those kinds of things. Those seem to be unique with Burge and the people at Area 2. When he was fired and all of this came to light, most of those extreme tactics, which were used only in that one, primarily in that one police station or area of the city, which was an African-American part of the city, seemed to stop. However, the kind of day-in and day-out inhuman treatment of beating people and holding them incommunicado and that kind of abuse goes on and went on and continues to go on in all of the stations, whether they be Hispanic stations or they be African-American stations or they be poor white areas of the city. The kind of torture that you see now is more the kind of using stun guns. You've got the devil's chair that's used in a lot of places around the country where we see a lot of people.
What is the devil's chair?
Devil's chair is the chair that they strap you into, and they're only supposed to, and you can't move, and they're only supposed to hold you there for a short time in only very limited circumstances, but it's become a method of torture, of punishment, and of coercion.
Yeah, and we're becoming way too familiar with different sorts of torture. Flint Taylor from the People's Law Office in Chicago, thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder. We'll post updates on lawanddisorder.org.
We'll get you back on the show. Keep track of the developments, Flint. Keep up the good work, and thanks for appearing on Law and Disorder.
Oh, you're very welcome. Happy to do so.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Yes, this is the ghetto. Shown up now.
We're very happy to have in the studio Zaid Dorn, who's written a play called Haymarket. It's opening up December 8th. We urge everybody to go see it. We want to talk to him about what the play's about, why he wrote it. Zaid Dorn, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you here. We're with Michael Ratner and Heidi Boghossian, Dahlia Hashad. I'm Michael Smith. And we've all got tickets to see the play on the 10th, but I understand that it'd be nice to have people there on the 8th and the 9th as well. We'll get out the information how you get tickets. But in the meantime, I wanted to set the stage about what was going on. The Haymarket, of course, is a famous turning point in the history of American labor struggles. And it goes back to May Day, May 1st of 1886 in Chicago. And of course, after the Civil War, when slavery was defeated, the burgeoning city of Chicago with all those workers, a lot of immigrant foreign workers,
and they talked not about slavery but about wage slavery. There was a big demonstration of 80,000 people on May Day, on May 1st, 1886. Tell us what happened and what led to the events later on about Haymarket. What's the play about?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is, I mean, 1886, this was the original May Day, really. At the time, May 1st was not the kind of international workers' holiday it is today. And what happened is Chicago became the sort of focal point for the eight-hour day movement. You know, the workers all over the country were striking to get an eight-hour day. And the anarchists in Chicago, particularly Albert Parsons, who's the kind of central character, one of the central characters in this play, became spokesman for the eight-hour day. And on May 1st, Albert Parsons and his wife, Lucy Parsons, led this crowd of 80,000 people, like you say, up Michigan Avenue in Chicago, and, of course, terrified the government of Chicago. It was a huge showing for a militant labor movement at that time. And 3 days later, on May 4th, when the anarchists held a gathering in the Haymarket, the police came in to try to break it up. Somebody in the crowd, somebody who was never identified, threw a dynamite bomb into the regiment of police, and the bomb exploded, killed a couple of police officers, and or one police officer at that time, mortally wounded seven of them. The police started shooting back, and several workers were killed. Nobody knows how many. And so the play kind of starts in the aftermath of that bomb and follows the trial and the kind of resulting Red Scare that happened.
Tell us about Parsons, Albert Parsons and Lucy Parsons, because both of them are really extraordinary figures, aren't they?
They really are. I mean, they're amazing people and just incredibly unique in the history of America, I think, and certainly in American radical politics. Albert Parsons grew up in Texas, was a Confederate soldier, kind of an aristocrat. His ancestors came over on the Mayflower. And his wife, Lucy Parsons, was an African-American woman, a former slave.
And part Native American, too.
Part Native American, part Mexican. And yeah. Actually kind of went as a – she never quite acknowledged her African roots. Miscegenation was illegal in Texas at the time. So when she married Albert, who was a white man, she put Mexican Indian on her certificate and went as that for the rest of her life. But yeah, they both became these militant anarchists, and kind of an amazing reversal for Parsons, for Albert Parsons, who was a Confederate soldier and all the rest of it. And for Lucy Parsons, as you said at the beginning, I think she saw this intimate connection between slavery, which she had experienced personally, and wage slavery, which she saw as more or less interchangeable.
When they were indicted really for the same thing that people are getting indicted these days for, the prosecutor's dream conspiracy. What happened when they were indicted?
The city really needed to do something. I mean, people were scared. This was a kind of a seminal act of violence in American political history. I mean, nobody had quite seen anything like this at the time of a bomb being thrown at police officers in a major American city during a demonstration. So what happened is, yeah, they rounded up the prominent anarchists in the city, and Albert Parsons was one of them. There were seven others. They indicted them for conspiracy to murder, and nobody was ever tied directly to the crime, but they found writings that advocated violence against police, and they used that as a way to say there had been a conspiracy to kill.
They throw in the kitchen sink, and they hope it sticks. Talk a little bit about the others, too. August Spies, I remember, was one. I mean, it's really like the leadership of the labor movement in Chicago, various organizations. It wasn't not only the anarchists, but it was the organization that became the American Federation of Labor, organization that became the Socialist Labor Party. There's a lot of kind of a broad-based coalition there. They just like when they – during the war in Vietnam, the Chicago Seven, when they got the entire leadership of the anti-war movement, the same kind of thing happened in Chicago. It was like the leadership of the whole movement.
Yeah, the leadership and the intellectuals. I mean, they had – Albert Parsons was the editor of The Alarm, which was a major newspaper, and – August Spies, the editor of the Arbeiter Zeitung, which was another famous anarchist.
Yeah, he's a colleague of Karl Marx.
Absolutely. So they really got the people who had been the kind of the spokespeople and the kind of brains behind the militant labor movement in Chicago.
And they convicted him, I know. And how many of the eight that were indicted were executed?
Four of them, eventually.
And what were they convicted of?
They were convicted of conspiracy to murder and inciting violence against the police. Four of them were executed in 1887. Two of them, their sentences were commuted to life in prison. One of them killed himself in jail. And many years later, of course, they were all pardoned posthumously.
Yeah, John Peter Altgeld pardoned them. He was a friend of Clarence Darrow's.
Exactly.
And that ruined his political career.
Yep.
What year were they pardoned?
1893, I think.
Did the other one die in jail, the last one?
Louis Ling, he killed himself. He put a blasting cap in his mouth and set it off. It was before the other ones were executed.
Yeah.
Now, how did the play come about? Did you write and produce?
No. I wrote it, and it was produced in Boston a year ago, and a New York producer saw it and had brought it to New York.
Mm-hmm. And how many cast members?
Six.
And is there any political line in the play, emotional line?
Yeah, well, there's a frame in the play, which is kind of another sort of tragic story of the Haymarket, the kind of aftermath of it, which is that the children of Albert and Lucy Parsons, who had their father executed when they were very young, went on to lead very difficult lives, as you can imagine. And this play, it starts with the daughter of Albert and Lucy Parsons, who, I mean, in the play, I've combined the two children, but Lucy Parsons ended up committing one of her children to a mental hospital. And so part of the play is set there, and part of the play is set in the kind of weeks after the bomb as Albert Parsons goes away to Wisconsin to try to escape what he knows is the coming persecution and then ends up returning to, you know, face the trial and try to help the people who are on trial there.
Said, why did you write the play, and what do you hope today's audiences will get from it?
Yeah, I started the play kind of several months after 9/11, when I think a lot of writers and people were trying to think about how to respond and what it all meant. And for me, at the beginning, all it meant was here we are in the moments after this explosion of violence in our own city. And how does a city deal with that on every level? How do activists deal with that? How does the government deal with that? How do ordinary citizens and police officers deal with that? And so the characters in the play, I mean, there are police, elected officials, anarchists, journalists, other people. And I want to just think about, how does violence disrupt our lives? How do we respond? How can we respond as a just society? And how do we usually respond as an unjust society?
So you would like people to draw some lessons for the current time?
I think there have to be lessons. I mean, I think we see history, you know, repeating itself so obviously in so many ways. And the aftermath of the Haymarket bomb was really one of the first Red Scares in American history. And I think that
tell us about that a little bit.
Okay. Well, I mean, really, the hysteria surrounding the bomb meant that when it became clear that the anarchists had something to do with it, or at least that the bomb had gone off at an anarchist rally, the word anarchist just became this symbol for everything wrong with American society, the same way the word terrorist is now. And, of course, it wasn't Muslim terrorists then, but it still had an element of xenophobia. There was this sense of European leftists coming to, you know, attack American soil. And so a lot of the anarchists were Germans, for example. There was this kind of massive, in the press, certainly, just an outcry against anarchists and editorials that make what we see today look reasonable, in the sense that you'd have editorials calling for the blood of any you know, anarchist who professed to being, you know, to having this political ideology. And so there really was a sense that if you're an anarchist, you should be hanged. And it wasn't like if you bombed somebody, you should be hanged. It had to do with the political ideology.
Were there anarchist unions at this point in the 1880s?
Well, the anarchists participated in the unions. I don't know if they had their own unions, but they were actively engaged in the labor movement and kind of trying to pull it to the left and make it, you know, radicalize it. And
yeah, there were syndicalists in Chicago that believed that the union movement was also the revolutionary organization for people to join.
Absolutely.
I hope people got their pens, because this play starts, Haymarket starts December 8th, and we're going to give you the phone number to call. You get a ticket. I think it's $15 for a ticket for Haymarket, 278-4200, and it's playing over on West 42nd Street. We're here with Zayd Dorn on Law and Disorder, talking about the play that he's written, Haymarket. Zayd, what are your hopes that you'll accomplish with this play here in New York?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I guess I hope that people... that it makes people think about what's going on today. I mean, obviously, the historical moment, I think, is an interesting moment. And I think it's important because it really, in so many ways, is the seed of American radicalism, or at least one of the major seeds. And of course, also to the response to American radicalism. I mean, it originated so many of the things we now think of as central. I mean, May Day and the 8-hour movement and radical labor politics and all this. And so...
Now, did May Day actually come out of this?
Yeah, May Day. It came out of this, and of course, after these anarchists were executed, they became symbols, you know, martyrs, really, for the revolution all over the world. And so the International May Day is really a response to the Haymarket.
Yeah, in 1889, the Second International, mm-hmm. worldwide voted to make May Day the International Workers' Holiday. And of course, it was that all the way up until the 50s when the United States government got so upset about having an International Workers' Holiday, they changed May Day into Law Day. So now we can't celebrate.
Now that's one of my favorites, that May Day is now in the United States Law Day. But now let me ask you, when we started our U.S. Labor Day, was that was done purposely, I presume, so that we didn't celebrate May Day as the Workers' Day? Is that
To have a workers' holiday that wasn't a radical holiday, to have a time when people could celebrate being labor without being radical labor, I think.
Now, I actually like the idea of May 1st as Law Day if we're applying it to the government. And the play is Haymarket, and it plays from what date, Zaid?
December 8th to the 23rd, every day except Tuesday.
It just sounds fantastic. I'm really excited about it.
The hosts here at Law and Disorder are going to be there on December 10th. Come up and say hello to us. You'll know us by – how are they going to know us, Dahlia?
They'll have to log on to the website, check us out, and then identify us that way.
Well, this is great, Zaid. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Best of luck with it.
Thanks for being on Law and Disorder, Zaid.
I appreciate it.
Seems I've got to have a change of scene, because every night I have the strangest dream. Prison by the way it could be. Left here on my own, or so it seems. I've got to leave before I start to scream. Someone's locked the door and took the key. You're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Oh, you sure took me for one big ride. And even now I sit and wonder why. That when I think of you I start to cry. Just can't waste my time, I must keep trying. Gotta stop believing in all your lies, 'cause there's too much to do before I die. You're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself. Well, you're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself. Felt that way, but that was then and now it's today. Can't get up yet and so I'm here to stay, till someone comes along and takes my place with a different name, yes, a different face. You're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself.